This is the Sophia Mare Studios podcast. Hi, I'm Amy.
And I'm Jess, and we're the Rambling Raven Puffs.
Because Potterheads are far too nuanced to be shoved into just one Hogwarts house.
Each week, we will cover two chapters in the saga of our favorite boy wizard.
All the while exploring literary themes, tarot card exercises, and even fanfic speculations.
To connect with us, your fabulous host, and other listeners, join the Discord server for Sophomere Studios.
And to support the podcast and gain access to exclusive bonus features, consider joining our Patreon page at patreon.com/sophiamarestudios, all lowercase.
Thank you for tuning in, grab your butterbeer, and enjoy the show.
Welcome again to the Rambling Raven Puffs. Welcome to the show, everyone. I'm Amy.
And I'm Jess.
And today we're covering Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire, chapters 33 and 34, The Death Eaters and Priori Incantatum. In these chapters, Voldemort has serious daddy issues.
We could call this Voldemort's monologue. Like, that's what my alternate title for this, the Death Eaters chapter, is.
Yes. And we get a crazy golden spider web dome thingy.
Yeah.
And wand ghost.
There was a lot happening there that I had to, like, pause to try to visualize. So it was a lot. It was a lot.
Indeed. So, what do you think of Voldemort as a villain? Because now you've gotten his evil guy, bad guy monologue.
Yeah. So, you know, I think that my own mystery of my own life is, like, my familiarity and how much I know about Harry Potter. And I never really got to understand, like, his kind of big bad reveal. And it was, I kind of didn't know when he became something more than just kind of a, you know, something kind of nebulous, kind of in the shadows, and kind of this threat that wasn't ever realized. And here it was. And I think kind of more interesting to me than his shenanigans were, like, who the Death Eaters were, and who kind of we picked out, and then who was absent. That's something I'd like to talk about too. Mm-hmm.
Yes. So the first thing Voldemort does is when he regains his body, because again, this dude has just climbed out of a cauldron full of disgusting shit of his father's bone, Harry's blood, and Wormtail's hand.
The most, you know, macabre soup ever.
Yes. And he asks Wormtail for his arm. And Wormtail thinks he's going to heal him, but he's like, your other arm, Wormtail. And there's a tattoo there, like the same as the basically the dark mark, the skull with the snake coming out as like a tongue. I know it's so serious, but I just, you know, when he like basically puts the wand at the dark mark and it starts like burning black and it's like, who will be brave enough to face me and who will be cowardly to run away? And I'm just thinking, what if they were in the shower?
Oh, dang.
What if they were doing number two when this summons up came?
That's so funny. That would be very interesting to see that happen. Thankfully, I guess they were all just like chilling and reading or something. I don't know what they were doing, but
I'm just surprised that they came that quickly, because the idea is that this tattoo thingy has been dormant for 13 years and then it suddenly burns. Again, I guess we don't know the exact magic behind it, but yeah, you know, he summons them and they come.
And the thing that this revealed to me, because I'm kind of thinking about it in popular culture, is I've seen people with that tattoo, like, mm-hmm. you know, in real life, and I've kind of been like, all right. And then, so now I kind of have an understanding of what that is.
And then Voldemort says to Harry, "You stand, Harry Potter, upon the remains of my late father, a muggle and a fool, very like your dear mother, but they both had their uses, did they not? Your mother died to defend you, and I killed my father, and see how useful he has proven himself in death." I didn't think of this dynamic before, but this whole crazy cult ritual shit did not need to physically happen in that graveyard. Like, he could have gotten the bone of his father's grave and had this ceremony ritual thing be in any other place. I've thought a lot about Voldemort's daddy issues, but specifically his choice to, you know, we know he's been hiding out in the Riddle House in his, like, father and muggle grandparents, like, old estate. But the fact that he chooses to be reborn again, like, at his father's grave, I think is very telling. And again, his whole monologue recommuning with his Death Eaters on this site, I think it's very saying, "See, Dad, I am good enough. I am worthy." And it's
It also reminded me, so I've made no secret of, I love Twilight. So I've been rewatching the movies and before I have a chance to read the books, because I don't know, there's just so much to read and watch and whatever. But this kind of reminded me of Rosalie when she's like walking around and killing people in her wedding dress. And she says something like, you know, "I was a little theatrical back then." I feel like there's a bit of the flair of the drama too for Voldemort, because you're right, he didn't really need to have this all take place there. But I think like he kind of relishes in that setting. I agree too. It's kind of like, "F you, Dad, look at me now," a little bit too.
It's also very telling just how Voldemort reconciles his status as a half-blood and yet being the leader of this sort of pure blood movement. And again, the fact that it's, again, one thing to do the ceremony here, but also summoning his Death Eaters here. So he's not hiding from his Death Eaters, it seems, that, yeah, my father was a muggle and I killed him. So it's just an interesting, like, a weird way he's reconciling his self-loathing and self-hatred over being, you know, a half-blood, yet is still able to command the respect of a lot of prominent purebloods and be able to lead this sort of pureblood supremacy movement.
That's something that I kind of was surprised about. And we may have talked about this, or we didn't. I think maybe we did, and it doesn't really matter. But the fact that he does have one parent that is muggle-born and one parent that is a wizard, and the fact that he has become so powerful because, like, even Harry Potter himself is, his, you know, parentage is both wizard parents.
Although Voldemort's father wasn't muggle born. That means you're a wizard born in parents. His father was a muggle, like, no magical ability.
Okay. So his parents, it was like one wizard, one muggle. And
yeah. Okay. One witch, one muggle.
One witch, one muggle.
Yeah. And then we've got Death Eaters swooping in. Yeah. And Voldemort's like, 13 years since we last met, yet you answer my call as though it were yesterday. There's been a ton of memes online about the pandemic, and it's like post-pandemic. It's like, here we are 13 years later with Voldemort.
Oh my God. It's probably going to be that way. I'm getting ready. I don't know. Yeah. I liked the use of 13 in the kind of, you know, there's kind of always some people associate that with bad luck. So I thought that was
nice. And basically, he's like, none of you bitches came to look for me.
He is. He really kind of shames them all. He's, and they're all feeling a little kind of, I don't know, I would say a little sheepish about it. Wormtail is kind of the one who's helping him out, giving him the assist. But yeah, interesting.
Yeah, and he's going through this whole, again, Socratic method monologue. And then I ask myself and I answer myself. You know, it's like, again, why didn't you guys come back? Look for me. Look at Wormtail. Why the hell would they come back to that?
Right. And the kind of the risk and reward for this, like, if they did kind of continue to serve Voldemort, As far as they know, they were kind of SOL if they put it out in the public, because mm-hmm. how kind of bad he is in the wizarding world, to the point where people won't even say his name, but the people who do show up, very interesting.
Mm-hmm. And so one of them, you know, throws himself at Voldemort's feet. It's like, "Master, forgive us." And it's, you know, and Voldemort tortures him. And it's like, "Get up, Avery. You ask for forgiveness? I do not forgive. I do not forget. 13 years. I want 13 years of repayment before I forgive you." And even Wormtail, he acknowledges, "You returned to me not out of loyalty, but out of fear of your old friends. You deserve this pain, Wormtail. You know that, don't you?" And then finally, he gives in and heals Wormtail's arm by giving him some crazy Luke Skywalker magic prosthetic.
I was thinking of, hopefully, if you listen to the Amy's other podcast, Podcasters Landing, Jamie Lannister, and he has that hand. So,
yes, he does. Basically, yeah, it's not even like skin like; it's just pure like silver. Mercury-esque, metallic-y, I don't know what.
Just some kind of, like, well, I was trying to think about it, and I guess it's functioning as a normal hand, but just kind of shiny. I don't know. Like, I don't know.
Basically like a robot, like kind of sort of the Anakin Skywalker and Luke Skywalker prosthetic. He can control it, but it's just not flesh.
Gotcha, okay.
And were you surprised that Lucius had shown up?
I was really surprised with some of these people. I mean, I think yes, definitely was surprised with Lucius showing up, and you know, because it was an accusation that the kids had made and suspected, and this is proven true. I think so many things that the Golden Trio kind of like talk about, they're kind of, you know, speculative. You know, we know Snape is like horrible and whatever, and there's some allusions here to somebody at Hogwarts, which I have my thoughts. But it was just Lucius, right? It is not his wife, and Draco is not there either.
No, it's just Lucius, and we kind of get the reveal that it was Lucius Malfoy who was one of the head, if not the leader, of the sort of chaos at the Quidditch World Cup.
Okay. So, yeah, exploits were fun.
And then, but Voldemort calls him out, "And yet you ran from my mark when a faithful Death Eater set it into the sky last summer. Yes, I know all about Lucius. You have disappointed me. I expect more faithful service in the future." I like Lucius as a character, as a complicated character. He's one of my favorite villains, but that being said, he isn't the most intelligent or smartest villain in that way. He does screw up in a lot of ways and will continue to screw up in the future, as we will see with further books. But it's just, I just like the dynamic with Voldemort and Lucius, because Lucius is from a very prominent pureblood family. And basically, as I mentioned a lot on this podcast, he has social capital that Voldemort needs to legitimize his movement, because Voldemort doesn't have the sort of pure bloodline family to stand on his own. He needs people like Lucius, who are basically these super wealthy socialites that can, you know, influence things.
That's interesting. And it's interesting how I thought the thing that was interesting to me, it was like, in the world so far that we've encountered Lucius Malfoy, is he bows to no one, you know, like you bow to him, not the opposite. So the fact that he's kind of like sniveling and at Voldemort's feet was really interesting to me, just to kind of reinforce how highly Voldemort is thought of in these, in this,
how feared.
Yeah. Feared, probably the better word.
Yeah. So, and then after Lucius, it's like, basically, they're kind of in the sort of circle, and I guess they know what places in the circle they're supposed to be, because there are a few spaces missing. And it's like, this Lestranges should stand here. They were faithful. They are currently in Azkaban. We will release them, and they will be rewarded, of course, for being loyal to me. And remember, like in the Pensieve, that woman was saying, "Throw us in Azkaban. We will wait. He will reward us, for we were the only ones who tried to find him."
That makes me, the thing that it made me think of when I'm in this section was like, how? Like, what does he have? I don't know if, you know, is he sitting on like a bunch of money? Like, what does this mean? How is he going to reward them? Maybe I'll find out. But right now he just like emerged from a cauldron made of like bones and he looks like a snake. Like, that's, I would kind of be like, okay, what am I doing? Other than, I guess, power. I don't know.
Yeah. McNair shows up, and then Crab and Goyle, fathers of the children, Crab and Goyle.
Ah, okay. I was like, Crab and Goyle, what the hell?
Yeah. And here we have 6 missing Death Eaters, 3 dead in my service, 1 too cowardly to return, he will pay, 1 who I believe has left me forever, he will be killed, of course, and 1 who remains my most faithful servant and who has already re-entered my service. So, he is at Hogwarts, this faithful servant, and it was through his efforts that our young friend arrived here tonight. So, do you have any thoughts about who that faithful servant is?
It is not Snape, I know that. It's Barty Crouch, right? Like, it has to be. Amy's not going to tell me, which is fine. That is not her job to tell me that. But obviously, I feel like my first instinct as a reader is to think of Snape, but obviously we know Snape probably wouldn't put Harry's name in the cauldron. So it's Barty Crouch. Anyway.
Alrighty. And so Voldemort goes into this, again, his whole monologue that he tried to kill Harry Potter. The spell backfired because Lily tapped into the really old sacrificial, like, love magic that protected Harry. And Voldemort lost his body. He's lost his powers. He was basically, you know, less than spirit, but still I was alive. And he ultimately kind of somehow managed up in a forest in Albania, of all places.
Yeah. So he's kind of creeping around.
And so he would possess animals, but they were not magical enough, and like him possessing them would shorten their lives. And so he would basically be the evil spirit ghost chilling in this Albanian forest. And finally, we get the little story of how Quirrell first bumped into him.
Yeah, that was a little bit of a throwback there with Professor Quirrell. Exciting.
Yeah, which again, the sheer chances of a Hogwarts professor. What is in Albania? I'm just curious. And were the Jorgens in Albania? Like not, no shade to like Albania people, but I'm just curious. What the hell?
I don't know. Something must be popping off there. I don't know.
Like, if anything, I feel like it's like tapping into some old school, like Cold War, like ethos of, you know, demonizing Eastern Europe.
I'm sure, you know, we talk a lot about that in the Sublimely Gothic, just like the demonization of other cultures. And maybe, I don't know.
Anyway, and then, you know, we get the whole summary of the Philosopher's Stone debacle. He goes back to Albania after Quirrell is dead. And then Wormtail finds him because Wormtail is able to communicate with the other rats, who tell him that there's this creepy ass ghost in the forest that preys and possesses and kills little creatures like them.
I'm not laughing because it's funny. It's just, to me, it's just like so weird to like imagine these little rats like chattering, like having a little conversation, like, watch out for this weird thing that's coming,
like,
for you.
Like, they're at the pub on a little mushroom as a table.
Little rat ears or whatever. Little.
Yes. But yeah, so Wormtail finds Voldemort, and through Wormtail, Voldemort is able to at least obtain a physical corporeal body, albeit very weak and basically, you know, baby-like, the thing that was dropped in the cauldron.
Yes.
And the thing that Frank Bryce saw before he died.
Yeah, all very creepy and horrible.
And so and then we get the whole thing of Wormtail lured Bertha Jorkins. I basically destroyed her body and mind after I got the information I needed from her and killed her.
Poor Bertha, man. She just, you know, trying her best, and this is how she ends up.
Yep. And then it was decided that, okay, I need to get my body back. There's this potion, but I need the blood of my enemy. And Wormtail wanted to use anyone, but I knew I would need the blood of Harry Potter.
Again, drama queen. Like, I mean,
drama queen, and even just the whole nature of whatever servant he has at Hogwarts, couldn't that guy or woman have enchanted any object to be a portkey? Or the only thing I can maybe think of is that, like, there's no apparition allowed in, like, teleportation at Hogwarts. Likewise, maybe portkeys don't work in Hogwarts, and so the only way to get, like, an object kind of outside of Hogwarts where it would kind of not be in that parameter would be like the Triwizard Tournament, like the cup. Like, that's the only reason that kind of makes sense of this whole drama of the Porky having to be the Triwizard trophy.
That makes sense. Yeah, there must be like a no Porky rule. I feel like, you know what, that would make better sense, because it's kind of like the portkeys kind of show up and we're in book four, right? Yeah. And all of a sudden, and that kind of makes sense. There, I don't think we ever read about there was a rule against them explicitly, but it would make sense that there was.
Yeah, it would make sense. And yeah, just because, and it's an interesting twist, because the whole rhetoric that we've been led to believe is that someone put Harry's name in the Goblet of Fire as a means of harming him via the task and possibly making it look out like an accident, but the actual goal was to have him win.
Right, which, kind of makes that assessment very different to the motivation to maybe make the tasks in his favor, or, you know, kind of know what his strengths and weaknesses are.
Mm-hmm. And let's see what we got. And then Harry, you know, and here he is. The boy you all believed had been my downfall. And he tortures Harry.
This is a little much. Like, I know that, you know, first of all, I'm reading this knowing that we have several more books. So Harry Potter's not going to die. I mean, that would be very strange.
It'd be George R. R. Martin.
Yes, it would be. It would very much be. And we know that that is not the road we're going down. So I tried to put myself in the headspace of a reader who picked up this book, not knowing if there were more books after, and just how, like, I would be like going, oh my God, are they going to kill Harry Potter this early on? You know, for like, is this it? Because, you know, there's not much book left at this point. So this could very well, I don't know what I don't remember if people knew there were more books coming out or what, but people would be reading this and going, okay, there's only a few more chapters. Maybe this is the end of the story. We don't know.
And again, drama queen Voldemort. He's like, and now I'm going to prove my power by killing him here and now in front of you all, where there is no Dumbledore to help him and no mother to die for him. You know, now untie him, Wormtail, and give him back his wand.
So he kind of kicks his ass a little bit, and then he's like, okay, now you're going to fight me, which is real cool.
Yeah, Voldemort. And that immediately transitions into chapter 34, Priori Incantatum, which I felt, you know, doesn't it show, like, Voldemort's weakness? Again, just the psychology of bullies. Like, you're picking on a 14-year-old boy, and you're the most powerful dark wizard. We're the only person that can possibly stand against you. And, like, direct combat would be, like, Dumbledore himself. So it's like, doesn't this undermine his power that he needs to, like, bully this 14-year-old? But on the other hand, I think he's trying to show his Death Eaters that, again, there's this whole mythos around Harry that it could be good, a good thing, benign, it could be malevolent, but there's this potential mythos and theory and speculation that maybe Harry has this super crazy amount of power.
Right, yeah.
That he's not fully aware of and her hasn't tapped into yet. So I think it's trying to, in this way, he's trying to debunk the Harry Wizard Jesus Christ, you know, module.
that makes complete sense. He's kind of trying to say like, yeah, you guys, you know, there's all this talk about how badass this kid is, but he's really just a kid and I'm going to show you.
Yeah, and he's just a kid and I overlooked his mother's like sacrificial magic and that was it.
Right. Yeah. So
there's nothing more to it.
I really, you know, but you kind of said of the bully mentality, and for some reason I must have Game of Thrones on the mind, I think, but I was thinking of there's like a fight in Game of Thrones and it's kind of, well, there's one fight in all Game of Thrones. Did you know? No, there are several, but there is one that I'm thinking of specifically. And I think it's the mountain versus,
the Red Viper.
He's like the little guy where he, Pedro Pascal, I think, is who played him anyway.
Yeah, Oberyn Martell, the Red Viper.
Okay. For some reason, that comes to mind where there's this guy who has a huge physical advantage to, it ends in a way. I won't say anything if somebody hasn't read Game of Thrones. I don't know. But anyway, that's kind of what it reminded me of, that kind of
huge power imbalance.
Yes. Yeah.
Which, and again, to me, that doesn't even hold true as much because at least the Red Viper, Oberyn Martell, he was known for his poisons and his like swiftness and his ability. Again, it's more of like a brute strength versus like agility and like, again, more Eastern martial arts. Like, you know, I feel like they're on the same level. They're just two very different fighting styles. Harry's not even an Arya Stark who has a needle, who's been maybe training a little bit and like can use his like smallness or, you know, to his advantage. He doesn't know shit at this point.
That's exactly. So then I guess I was thinking like poor Harry and putting like in this situation, like you're like at level two. And like, and this Harry, guy is Harry's at level.
Harry's a white or yellow belt at this point.
Exactly. And you're facing like a 5-time black belt. And I'm like, we're doing this? Like, what is going on? So it
because
was, yeah.
Because, you know, not to shit on all of Harry has accomplished at this point, but none of his adventures have really demanded direct, like, dueling another wizard. A lot of times it's been, like, outsmarting, dangerous creatures or, like, right, solving riddles and puzzles and, like, magical complex, like games, like again, direct combat. This is totally outside of Harry's like expertise and knowledge.
This also, like, this is so silly for me to mention, but I just started a new job and I'm like Harry Potter right now trying to fight Voldemort with like, what the hell is going on? Like, I'm level one and I'm fighting this like giant beast. So I wish I had some magic to help me out, but I don't.
Yeah. So. And Voldemort's like, you have been taught to duel, Harry Potter. It's like, we bow to each other, Harry. Again, such a fucking drama queen.
This made me think of, and I'm so glad you brought this up, but we bow to each other. The niceties must be observed. Dumbledore would like to you to show manners. This reminded me in modern life of work culture a little, little bit, how we're all kind of expected to put on this facade of being, you know, polite and nice and, you know, really kiss each other's ass. Just pretend everything's fine when maybe everything's on fire. So I kind of thought toxic positivity. Exactly. That is exactly what this reminded me of. Like, we, even though it's horrible, we're going to keep up the niceties. And I'm like, ugh, God, it just makes it so much, it just adds a level of gross, which is what Voldemort's doing. Like, you still have to, we still have to bow to each other. Like, you can't forego that. Give me a break.
Yeah. And it's like I said, bow, and kind of Harry, he uses the Imperious Curse to force Harry to bow. Yikes. And we duel. And again, like, getting, you know, and my first instinct is to think that, yeah, like, Voldemort's just undermining himself by taking on a 14-year-old boy, but again, he feels compelled to disprove this, you know, wizard Jesus boy, you know, theory. So
right, and he's like, he's really, it's a bad time for Harry at this beginning part.
Yeah, and he stops torturing Harry, and he's like, a little pause, that hurt, didn't it, Harry? You don't want me to do that again, do you? And Harry doesn't, you know, play along. He doesn't say no. And then Voldemort's like, you know, he puts him under the Imperius curse, just answer me. And Harry's just like, I won't. Which just shows an interesting dynamic of the Imperius curse, which I'm not sure if I'm totally on board with.
How do you mean? Tell me.
I just mean, you know, we've already discussed this, and this has been, you know, kind of explored with Professor Moody showing, you know, even then Harry was kind of resisting the Imperius curse. And, you know, I don't like the idea that it's just a matter of willpower, or that Harry is more strong-minded or than any others, like, you know, that Jedi tricks can't be used against him like other people. I like to think more that there's some sort of neurological genetic base that's just totally random, that Harry is more in the same way that people are more predisposed to depression. It's not, you know, there's some neurological wiring there, and it's not a matter of weakness. So I like to kind of think of it that way for Harry to be able to fend off. Because it also depends on, and especially having a super, like, genetic or biological base, because one of the most powerful wizards is putting this on Harry, and still Harry can say no.
Right, yeah. It only builds to get more interesting, I guess, in this this very early in Harry's dueling career battle against, like, the biggest challenger ever.
Yep. And Harry takes the first chance he gets to duck behind a tombstone.
Come on, man. Like, he's got
we are not playing hide and seek, Harry. You cannot hide from me. Does this mean you are tired of our duel? Does this mean you would prefer me to finish it now, Harry? Come out, Harry. Come out and play.
Ugh, gross. Yeah. Not a fan of him.
And ultimately, Harry's like, I'm not going to crouch like a kid. I'm going to go out fighting like my dad. And so he comes out, and Harry shouts, Expelliarmus. And Voldemort cries, Avada Kedavra. So Voldemort was ready to kill Harry at this point, because that's the killing curse.
Yeah.
And super magic shit happens.
Yeah. Like, this wild thing that obviously Voldemort wasn't expecting.
So break down your thought process when reading this.
I honestly had to kind of, like, go back and read it, because I don't know. I mean, again, I know Harry's not going to die right now. But I was having a hard time kind of envisioning what the hell was going on here. And again, knowing that Voldemort, you know, this is not what he expected to have happen either. But instead, there was, like, this kind of clash of, you know, wand magic stuff and creating this net. And then people are coming out of the wand. And it was very complicated for me to read.
So basically, you know, if you didn't fully catch on, basically, you know, their wands are connected by that golden beam. And there are these sort of, like, beads that are, like, sliding back and forth. And yes. Harry has, you know, they're come towards Harry's wand, and he pushes them back so that they touch Voldemort's wand. And so basically what prompts that is, it prompts the wand, Voldemort's wand, to show the last, you know, go through the Google search history of the wand, of Voldemort's wand.
Okay. Okay.
So what does it show? It first shows, like, in, you know, reverse order. So it shows the hand that he gave, like, a ghost of a hand that he gave Wormtail.
Okay.
And then, go ahead.
I forgot that this was a thing, because we talked about this a long time ago, right? Like, the Google search history of the wand, because at the...
Yeah, because that's how they found out that Harry's wand, which was in Winky's possession, was the wand that conjured the dark mark, again, because they ran the Google search history.
Yes, okay. Yeah, so then...
So in essence, in a form, that is what's happening now. So we first get the ghostly Wormtail hand prosthetic thingy. We get the ghost of Frank Bryce that Voldemort murdered. And, you know, Frank is like, oh, he really was a wizard. Don't let go now, boy. And then Bertha Jorkins comes out. Or wait, right. before any Oh, wait, before the hand, Cedric Diggory comes out, because, you know, that's he's the most recent human that Voldemort killed.
Right. And I'm just thinking, like, as this is all happening, like, how overwhelming this would be for, I guess, for me. And I can't think, like, Harry, he's trying to do all these things, and all of a sudden, all of these, like, you know, entities are coming out of this and one and talking to him.
And it's just interesting, you know, the idea of not only how I would react in that situation in Harry's perspective, but how I would react to how Voldemort is reacting, because he doesn't know what the fuck is going on. Like, it's not like, oh, yeah, maybe this can happen. It's inconvenient, or like, you know, or at least know something. He doesn't know shit right now.
Right. He's trying to show what a badass he is, you know.
Yeah, show what a badass. And what does he get? He gets the ghost of his murdered victims coming out of his wand.
Right, which has to be like, I mean, I don't know what face this snake man is making, but it's got to be like, what the hell is going on here? And then again, they're like talking to Harry, which is, I don't know. It's all very strange.
Yeah, so after Bertha... And then finally, it is Harry's mother.
Of course.
And then Harry's father.
Right.
And they tell him, you know, we'll only linger a little bit. The minute you break the connection, you have to run to the portkey.
Yeah. And then Cedric asks, like, hey, grab my body. Which, I mean, that's fine. But to you know, take back to my family. Which, of course, we know Harry's going to do, even though that's an additional risk. You know, if he wasn't a Gryffindor, maybe he was a Slytherin, he would just bolt and be like, "Forget your damn body, I'm out of here." But he's like, "No, he's doing the right thing, I guess."
Yeah, and if this was Game of Thrones, certainly would not go for the body.
Right, right. We'd be like, "Good riddance."
In this situation. Harry might stand from a little bit of Zoroastrian teachings, where they do not hold the same reverence for, like, the corpse in the same way that, like, Abrahamic religions do. Like, if anything, in Zoroastrianism, like, before Islam took over, like, in Iran and stuff, like, they would not bury the dead because the dead would be seen as, like, you know, would be as tainting the earth.
Yeah,
so it would be better to, like, leave them on these towers for the birds to eat. So interesting concept of how much, you know, we're just so used to so much reverence being put on the body, and just that's just not a thing, you know, or it wasn't a thing in Zoroastrianism. But yeah, anyway,
that kind of made me think about, you know, too, with Cedric kind of having a second life, we just offed him in a sentence or a couple chapters ago, and then he, you know, comes back as like a ghost. And when you were talking about, you know, bodies and things like that, that reminded me of Catelyn Doty, who wrote a book called Smoke Gets in Your Eyes about working as a mortician. It's very interesting.
Oh, yeah. So what did you think about, again, the metaphysical aspect of, again, this, we were first introduced to this sort of, you know, Google search history in the wand, as, again, purely as a sort of record to see what previous spells were. So what do you think about the fact that these ghosts are somewhat, it's not even just like a shadow or an image of the person, that the person seems to have a consciousness and is sentient and can tell Harry what to do with his parents, and even Cedric's making a deathbed request.
Yeah, very interesting. Well, you brought up ghosts, which is like my favorite thing. Amy very kindly gifted me a book about ghosts, and I have my ghost slippers on. So I love ghosts. But kind of, you know, ghosts might not be the appropriate term here even, because it's, I'm trying to think about, you know, how we've seen them in the books before. They're kind of comical and, you know, silly and whatever, they have a party, whatever. It was very interesting. I think I looked at it in a way to kind of save the reader a little bit, to kind of, you just had this shock of Cedric dying, and then he's kind of a presence. And Harry's parents have always kind of been a presence in, you know, they appear in a mirror, they do kind of these different things. So they're always kind of there. So that is really interesting, you know, the relationship with somebody who has died and how they appear in the wizarding world. And, you know, I don't know. I think that we could probably take that death in Harry Potter and how it's treated, because it's kind of not treated like as a permanent thing. Like their physical presence isn't there anymore, but, you know, they show up every now and then in a different way.
Yeah. Or at the very least, in the wizarding world, the ability to physically manifest one's memories and in other ways can, you know, can there be a physical manifestation?
Yeah. Very interesting the way that the deceased show up.
And so we get to a point where Harry finally breaks the connection and all the wand ghosts surround Voldemort, being like, fuck you, you suck. Who knows what they said to him. Because, just think that you're this murderer and suddenly all the ghosts of the people you killed are up in your face.
That's terrifying. First of all, me being a murderer. And second of all, like, all my victims are, like, surrounding me. I was reading this, I was like, don't mess around. Get the hell out of there, man, and get Cedric's body. And I did not remember Cedric's body was kind of a little further away, because I'm also thinking, you know, like, how is this going to happen? Like, dead bodies weigh, you know, it's not lightweight. So anyway, that all got good on Harry. And thank you, Hermione, for her teaching him.
Yeah, training him. And again, it's a nice, you know, come around. We had the portkeys introduced at the beginning of this book. Portkeys ended up being pivotal to the plot. And then we have, you know, the summoning charm, which was purely Eurytalian to get through the first test, but then it comes up again.
Right.
Saving Harry's ass.
Thank God.
Yep. So he runs and grabs Cedric's body, realizes, oh yeah, a dead body is really heavy. And then Voldemort's like literally on him smiling, I'm gonna get you. And then, but he quickly says Accio and gets the port key and bounces.
Thank goodness for that. And then we get to be in suspense again until Amy and I finish our conversation. So,
indeed. And thus concludes chapter 24. Yay. Almost done. Alrighty then. So let us move on to Gothic Geek Out.
I wrote chapter 33 just kind of in it's pretty, you know, we've had two kind of back-to-back chapters that are definitely kind of like the Gothic horror. And the Death Eaters, to me, could be kind of pulled out of this novel and made into their own Gothic story, and how they, you know, came to be in league with Voldemort. And just, I don't know. The Death Eaters are very interesting to me. I know we'll probably run into them more, but I kind of want to know more about their story. So, Gothic Death Eaters for me.
Yeah. And it's especially their story of radicalization, because definitely it doesn't specifically say in the books, but like I always imagine, you know, just a normal sort of black hood covering them. But in the movies, like they're like cloaks, they're like hats are like tipped. It's very, very specifically trying to evoke the imagery of the Ku Klux Klan.
Oh, interesting.
Except they're in black. So definitely trying to be like, yeah, these are basically like white supremacists, which they are in terms of their pure blood mania.
And then again, you said, but their leader is not a pure blood. So that's very interesting.
Exactly. And then, my notion of Gothic Geek Out was, of course, the wand ghost.
Yeah,
because in other Gothic stories, just having a ghost is like, oh my God, there's a ghost. Ooh, scary. You know, that's considered extraordinary. But in specifically this wizarding world, you know, we have ghosts. They do exist. So there is some sort of parameter for ghosts being in existence. But yet this is showing a form of ghost that is clearly unheard of, or at least only known by a very select few. So this form of ghost manifesting itself is even out of place and extraordinary and supernatural, even for the wizarding world.
Well, like you said, like even Voldemort was like, what's happening? Like he was kind of seemed
yeah, like
a little,
he didn't know what to do and probably was more terrified of them than Harry was, because not just that they're his victims, but again, you know, so much of what Voldemort has done has been to evade death. And so right. to see a sort of, again, despite, you know, there's normal ghosts, but to see his victims out of context in a really, in a sort of manifestation that isn't supposed to happen, like, you know, that would like scare the shit out of me.
Me too. Doesn't take much, but it definitely would.
Yes. Yeah, so anyway, so the wand ghost, that was my gothic geek out, a very obvious one, but yes.
It was, I mean, there was those were some good gothic chapters. I feel like we got a lot of like,
we already did the graveyard and like, you know, super culty cauldron crap, you know, before, like we had right. to pick a few other things. So next in our list of exercises is Tarot of the Day. And I'm just looking up the meaning, but the tarot card I pulled out today at random was the Star, which is card number 17 in the Major Arcana.
Okay.
So, as the Star follows the Tower card in tarot, it comes as a welcome reprieve after a period of destruction and turmoil. Go away, stupid internet ad, I don't want you. You have endured many challenges and stripped yourself bare of any limiting beliefs that have previously held you back. You are realizing your core essence, who you are beneath all the layers. No matter what life throws your way, you know that you can always connect to the divine and pure loving energy. You hold a new sense of self, a new appreciation for the core of your being. Well, not so much in a benign sense for Harry, but I feel like the Star very much replicates Voldemort's sense of triumph in having a new sense of self, in actually having a body.
That is like I'm like, it's taken me a minute to process, because usually the Star, when I've seen it in tarot, is like, oh, all good things and light. And to apply that to Voldemort, I love it. Like, he's having his Star moment in this, which is very good for him.
It was the song A Star Is Born.
Yes.
Oh, yeah, no. The Star brings renewed hope and faith and a sense that you are truly blessed by the universe. You are entering a peaceful, loving phase in your life filled with calm energy, mental stability, and more in-depth understanding of both yourself and others around you. This is a time of significant personal growth and development as you are now ready to receive the many blessings of the universe. Again, I wouldn't use all of this like love and light jargon, but I still think it applies to Voldemort, especially both in his physical body, you know, calling forth his, you know, minions so that he has his strength back in terms of his, like, army. And, you know, he was talking about the Dementors would join us. We can get everyone else to join us and we're going to crush this.
I love it. Like, this is, I think it's like a you heard it here first. Like, let's apply the Star card to Voldemort and his moment here. But if we look at him not as this, like, evil figure and just, like, which is so hard to remove that from his character, but just as like a being going through something, yes, he's surrounded by his people, like his followers, he's renewed hope and faith and personal growth, like all of those apply. So I am not going to argue with Amy on this. I am not going to take any different approach, because I'm thinking about like, I usually apply it to like the benevolent characters, and I'm thinking about Harry and, you know, Cedric's body about to just deliver to really kind of rock everybody's world back at Hogwarts, and not in a good way. But on the flip side, Voldemort is like, I am back. I didn't kick this kid's, you know, whatever, like I thought, this 14-year-old, but man, I really, all my people are here. I love it.
Yeah, so with the Star card, anything is possible and the magic is flowing around you. Your heart is full of hope and your soul is being uplifted to the highest of highs as you realize as your dreams truly come true. Allow yourself to dream, to aspire any way possible so that it can reach the stars. They are right here waiting for you. And then you're choosing the highest version of yourself. This is a profound spiritual journey that will bring great meaning and purpose into your life and will renew your inner energy. So the only time, you know, the Star kind of applies to Harry is when Harry finally gains the upper hand in Priori Incantatum, where, like, you know, I'm sure, not that we've personally witnessed it, but probably in later chapters, you know, the, you know, sort of spiritual growth and psychological and mental emotional growth Harry will have after having such a magical manifestation of seeing his parents in such a way.
Yeah.
Alrighty then. And then of the Black Moon astrology cards that I picked out, I actually picked, it was a planet card, and it was Jupiter.
If I can. Not Saturn. That would have been cool. But that's
okay. Oh, no, not Saturn. Again, you know. I could just lie and say that, oh, Saturn, but that's like, no, I'm true to my word, and I do these totally at random, because I choose to accept the messages from the universe as they come to me. The planet Jupiter casts off more heat than it takes from the sun, and thusly, the giant planet is one of generosity and joyfulness. In astrology, it is the great benefic, the soother of hurts and bruises, and promises a period of good fortune when hard luck is coming to an end. Similar to Saturn, Jupiter can represent the father and what you have inherited from your father. Jupiter corresponds to Greek Zeus, blah, 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 and the Norse god Odin. Because Jupiter is so vast and expensive, this planet is the gate opener for better luck. The earlier Greeks called planet Jupiter Phaethion, blah, 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 blah. As the ruler of Sagittarius, the centaur, Jupiter has a dual role of being half human, half beast. When the energy of Jupiter enters your reading, you can be assured luck is on your side and forges. Okay, so it's very much kind of like Wheel of Fortune, like lots of good luck and abundance, and like, again, kind of sort of paternal mentor energy, which again I think applies when the wand ghosts come to Harry to offer him like advice, you know, a game plan to get out of his situation.
That's, yeah, the only thing I thought about healing wise was the Wormtail getting his hand back.
This is true, because, and that is not to be discounted or dismissed outright, because as we can see, Voldemort is not very nice to his followers. And there's the whole debate that one can have that whether the Death Eaters are truly as sadistic as him, or at least are on the spectrum, or who are following him out of like blackmail and pressure because they know the alternative is to, you know, so Voldemort doesn't treat, we all see he doesn't treat his, you know, followers well, and he constantly insults and diminishes and demeans Wormtail, and yet still he had this quote-unquote generosity of giving Wormtail his hand, or that could be purely utilitarian in the sense that this guy's already hopeless, he'll be even more hopeless without a hand, I need to give him a hand.
That, yes. And then the fact that, like, he doesn't really destroy Lucius Malfoy. You know, I kind of anticipated him to like really come get after him, but I know that, you know, people with beings with that mindset, villainous characters are like, that was the nicest thing I have ever done, is to not like punish you for your lack of loyalty. So you're in my debt.
Yeah. So now you're in debt. Yeah. And clearly he doesn't see Avery as maybe possessing the same sort of usefulness as Lucius, because he had no qualms with torturing Avery.
Yeah. He's like, bye. Bye. Mm-hmm. And Voldemort's a Capricorn?
Yes. Voldemort and Snape are Capricorns.
Interesting.
I'm sorry. You said Capricorn and made me think of, have you seen that new animated movie on Netflix, Back to the Outback?
No. Uh-uh.
It's a really adorable thing where, like, these deadly creatures, like, don't want to be viewed monsters anymore, so they want to break out of the zoo and go to the wild and just be normal. And through a bunch of misadventures, they get this koala tagging along with them, who is really mean and bitchy and very arrogant, and he's just like, so what? I'm a Capricorn. And I'm just like, oh my god.
Well, I Capricorn is my opposite, so I, like, anyway.
Since Jupiter is strongly tied to the law and ideas of fairness, you may find your opinions and convictions rather strong at the present time. Juniper is represented by the largesse, so try not to become overbearing, as this attitude could sabotage all that you work for. So laws and ideas are ideals, again, a sort of pure blood mania, because they honestly believe that to be quote-unquote fair.
Right.
Yeah, but that's all I've got. Any other thoughts on Jupiter?
Not really. I only could think of, you know, in addition to just like the, I think my best application of it was, you know, the soother of pain and, mm-hmm, I don't know, the father of the Death Eaters, Voldemort.
Yeah. So. Alrighty then. And now we move on to our last exercise. Fan fiction time. So mine was interesting. Again, I was talking about what if the Death Eaters were in the shower. I'm just curious, like, what if none of them showed up?
Ooh, Voldemort would be like...
What if Voldemort was stood up?
Well, I was... You know, that's interesting because the Lestranges are in Azkaban. That's why they couldn't be there. And he, like, knows that, right? So that would be... First of all, his little... production would have like kind of fallen flat. It would, do you think he would have even attempted it if nobody could be there? Because he couldn't, like, I'm sure his intention is like, I want you all here to see this. So then you'll go and, Game of Thrones again, tell them it was me or whatever, you know, with, sorry, I don't know what, yeah, that was, it's on my mind, I guess. But anyway, so they're kind of like, there's a bit of the, like, I want you here to see this, so you'll go tell everybody. And if they weren't there, then it would kind of be like, well, what was the point? But then also it could be, you know, I almost think he might be a little excited if they were all in Azkaban, because that meant they were loyal, you know, like to the end.
Yeah, I just think about... again, how he perceives his sense of having a body back, but, you know, socioeconomically and sociopolitically, he doesn't have anything. He's starting from scratch. So if no one showed up, it's like, not that he couldn't get more followers, again, Dementors and maybe other things, but yeah, just, you know, thinking like, well, I'm back to square one, damn it.
Yeah, that's, I guess that's kind of like, you know, why I thought about, why is he... you know, they will be rewarded. It's kind of like, with what? Like, what do you have? So, I don't know.
Interesting. Yes. Yeah, it's... yeah, so that was just my, like, what if no one showed up? Because, again, I guess it's just a testament to the level of fear he inspires, that even after 13 years, they're just, like, on that shit immediately when they feel it.
Yeah, that's... My only thought, because this was such a monologue of Voldemort's, like, it was just like, dude, and, you know, him asking himself questions, it was just so crazy. So I thought about, what if that was told kind of in a different way? Like, what if Harry chose to write that chapter less of just kind of reporting back to what Voldemort said, and more of, not his, I was just trying to think of that whole chapter written from a different perspective. I don't know whose perspective I would have picked, but it was so heavy. Like, it could have just been Voldemort slipped it in there. If it was like, found a page from Voldemort's diary and he was like, today I went to the graveyard and I got all my friends or something like that. That was kind of my best shot. I feel like you can't really change. Well, not a lot. I liked yours. What if nobody showed up? But, and I think we kind of talked about, what if Cedric wasn't there? So what if it was just told in a different way?
Yeah. Well, again, the question, a lot of people think that, you know, bad guys having these sort of monologues is a necessary means of exposition for the reader to understand all of what's going on and the villain's motivation and yada, yada, yada. But I don't think that's entirely true, because I was watching one, like, sort of news clip documentary about, like, this, you know, the story of this fake socialite who was able to convince people that she was, like, you know, had a trust fund and was, like, and so people gave her free shit and presumed a lot about her when she had nothing. And so they interviewed an author who specifically had a, who wrote a book about, like, con artists, where con artists spoke to her, you know, under the promise of anonymity. And people are asking, like, oh, how did you get these con artists to talk to you? And she would laugh. It's like, they're desperate to talk about it. They're proud of it. They want to brag about it, but they can't, because obviously they need to, you know, not expose themselves. But there is, you know, not, this isn't just a writer's cheating exposition thing. Like, this is genuinely something in the narcissism of villainy, where people want to brag about how awesome and evil they are sometimes, and how they got away with shit.
That's right. So like this was he, there was no way that he, I guess I wouldn't, I don't have a degree. I can't diagnose him. And also he's a fictional character. I don't know why I said that, but you know, whatever, you know, mental thing, I think sociopath, people use that word a lot and it's misapplied often, but, this was kind of going to be his jam. I think, you know, now that I'm thinking it through a little more, it would be interesting if he didn't like give the whole spiel. If it was just like, he just kind of went through the motions and did the thing and without the kind of backstory, it might be a very less exciting, but
yeah, less exciting. But again, he has the very specific context of he feels he has to prove himself because this, you know, basically he goes through all this to say how awesome I am. And even, you know, to a certain point to admit that, yes, I made a mistake. I underestimated this type of sacrificial love magic and all of that. But he's making that concession, like purely in the grand scheme of things, to try and reiterate this kid is not special. Like, I am the shit and he's only alive. And I only had I only went on sabbatical because of my own, like, you know, misjudgment.
Well, that's all I had. Oh. It's the best I could do.
Yeah, that's all I had too. So, yep, exciting. So now no longer Voldemort is a sort of creepy shadow. He is fully corporeal and ready to wreak havoc on the world.
Oh, man.
Yes, so that's it for tonight, but tune in next time for chapters 35 and 36, Veritaserum and the Parting of the Ways. Catch you guys later. Bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to the Rambling Raven Puffs. Our theme music was composed by John Williams, recreated by Kinez Norwar. This podcast is but one of the many shows produced by Sophie Mare Studios. You can get the latest news by following our social media, Sophia Mare Studios on Instagram, Sophia Mare Studios on TikTok, and SophiaMare_pods on Twitter. You can connect with other listeners through the Sophia Mare Studios Discord server. You can support the show by becoming a patron at patreon.com/SophiaMareStudios, all lowercase. Higher tiers get access to even cooler perks. That was the Sophia Mare Studios podcast.